that Israel will within a decade have lost the support of the United States people.
Do you see anything in conflict between American principles of integration and separation of church and state with the support of Israel, which is obviously a Jewish state that under Kahana might expel non-Jews?
I think the only problem comes for Jews who hold on to democratic values and who feel because they're living in this country that that's the way things should be in this country or America or maybe in other Western democracies. But for the fact of Israel, I don't think that it is relevant. I think that Israel is a Jewish country. Its code or its constitution is the Bible, Judaism. And in Judaism, there is no conflict of, there is no separation of church and state.
I fear that Arab leaders will obtain the atomic capacity just as Israel, in its concern, has obtained an atomic capacity. And if an atomic warhead ever came into the hands of a Gaddafi or an Assad, and we have an atomic confrontation between this garrison state he speaks of and the hatred that the expulsion of all Arabs and Christians would engender, then I think we're guaranteed a nuclear war in our lifetime in that part of the world.
Let me, first of all, introduce Rabbi Meir Kahana, one of the most well-known Jewish leaders in the world, and certainly the most controversial. He organized the Jewish Defense League in 1968. He became spokesman for the philosophy Never Again, meaning that Jews will never again allow themselves to be victimized or terrorized or murdered. He is a member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Will you please welcome Rabbi Meir Kahana. Pete McCloskey is a graduate of Stanford University and the Stanford Law School. He served as an officer in the United States Marine Corps. He ran for the House of Representatives in 1967. He was elected, and then he was reelected seven times after that. He ran for the Republican nomination for the office of President of the United States in 1972. He is an author of books on political science. Would you please welcome Mr. Pete McCloskey. Let me begin with Pete McCloskey. The question is, who and what is behind Arab terrorism? Who supports it?
Terrorism in the Middle East has been going on since the Zionist movement first began to settle Jews in the area which was then the Palestinian Mandate after World War I. The Arabs who lived in the Palestinian Mandate resented any increase in Jewish population which would threaten their existence and their culture. And in 1943, when Menachem Begin left the Polish Brigade, the Jewish settlements commenced, in effect, a war against Arab residents in that area and vice versa. It's hard to say who were the more guilty. The Jews at that time felt that they had a right to rebel against the British Palestinian Mandate. Begin wrote a book called The Revolt, in which he justified blowing up the King David Hotel. He justified hanging two police sergeants of the British Army as an example to the British that the Jews were going to fight until they got their own country. In 1947, the United Nations adopted UN Resolution 181 of the General Assembly, providing for the partition of what was Palestine at that time into two areas, a Jewish area and an Arab area, with the city of Jerusalem to remain under international control. On May 15th, the British mandate expired. The State of Israel came into existence, was immediately recognized. by the United States and by the Soviet Union. And I think it's fair to say for the next 20 years until 1967, no Arab recognized the validity of either the UN resolution or the State of Israel. And the Arabs generally tried in every possible way to destroy that state through acts of violence. Now, what has the violence become today? Since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, what they call Judea and Samaria, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, the Arab world has generally justified acts of violence to deny that occupation of the West Bank and the other occupied territories. There were acts of terrorism by Arabs against Jews, and the people that commit those acts are generally young Palestinians, although not all. They are people who oppose the occupation of the West Bank, that believe there must be a Palestinian homeland, and until there is a Palestinian homeland, they will commit acts of violence to achieve it, just as the Jews did in 1947.
Thank you. Rabbi Kanaz.
There's no question that Arab terror is rooted in one particular fact: a refusal on the part of the Arabs to recognize the existence of a Jewish state of any size, of any shape, and of any form. And in 1967, when Israel, faced with a concerted attack by all the Arab states, including such moderates as Jordan, struck back and liberated Samaria and Judea, we now hear that the obstacle to peace today is the occupied lands of 1967. I never really understood why in 1947 the Arabs attacked Israel. Now I do. What was bothering them in 1947 was clearly the occupied lands of 1967. There were no Arab moderates. The trouble is that we want to believe it. Arab moderates kill Jews moderately. We are faced with an attempt on the part of Arabs who attempted to wipe out Israel physically beginning in the 1920s, long before there was an Israel or Kahana or Begin or Sharon, having been defeated in five wars and knowing that they cannot beat Israel through war, through violence. An effort is now being made for a salami tactic. 67 boundaries, and after that, perhaps the 47 boundaries. And when Hussein of Jordan announced that he would accept 242, 338, he also said that it would be within the context of all of the UN resolutions, including the first one, which he turned down, which they turned down, and which would bring the Arabs back to the 1947 boundaries. Arab terror is rooted in one fact: they refused to recognize the existence of the State of Israel.
Let me just add a personal experience of one thing that I think causes terrorism, and I would define terrorism as crime committed in the interests of what is perceived as a national or a group function. To the terrorist, he's striking out against injustice or oppression. The Israeli response in southern Lebanon to an act by a Shiite against an Israeli soldier has been to destroy a village or to bulldoze the home of an entire family if a young person from that family threw a rock at a passing Israeli truck. That concept of an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth or 10 teeth for 10 teeth, as Begin has put it, has led many, many people in the Arab world to consider acts of terrorism. I visited West Beirut in 1982 in late July. The Israelis had been given the cluster bomb by the United States, a weapon of devastating impact on civilians. It throws a lot of little bombs over an area about 25 acres in size, and they go off at 5-minute intervals for about 30 minutes and generally hit the old people and the children, not the soldiers who understand them. Israel violated that agreement with us. Here's the cluster bomb. I found them all over West Beirut. And on one occasion, we walked down a street in West Beirut with a congresswoman named Mary Rose Okar, who came from Syrian background. She asked a lady who was in the street poking under the rubble of a collapsed apartment building that had been devastated by the Israeli Air Force. She said, "What are you looking for?" And the lady responded, "I'm looking for the body of my son, my daughter. Her son, who was 12 years old, pointed a finger at me and he said, "You Americans have killed my little sister." To him, it was American weapons, American bombing, that had killed his little sister. That young man would be 18 at the present time, and I suspect that he might very well have conceived that the massacres at Shabra and Shatila, the conduct of the Israeli Air Force in walking these huge bombs through a city of 600,000 people, would justify an act of terrorism on his part. I think that many of these young people are the terrorists of today who have survived the refugee camps of the last 20 years.
Question number two. Rabbi Kahana, in your opinion, how should the world respond to the latest acts of Arab terrorism?
First of all, they have to begin to understand that they have to reject the nonsense that we've just heard here. Because as long as they begin to believe this nonsense, that in Lebanon, that's where terrorism, that's where Arab anger grew. Arab anger grew long before the Israelis went into Lebanon. And if you're speaking about Arab anger, what about Jewish anger? Massacred Jewish students, Jewish children in Malot, in Nahariya, in Beit Shan, in Aviv, long before we went into Lebanon. If anything, the incredible patience of Israel, which I consider to be insane. If the world wants to put an end to terror, it has to realize that the terror doesn't begin with the actions of good people. It begins with the actions of people who refuse to recognize the right of a sovereign nation to exist. And if you want to put an end to that terror, you can't be nice about it. During World War II, a war in which the Congressmen fought, Allied bombers bombed German cities. I hope he doesn't believe that we were only killing generals. I presume that he didn't picket the White House for bombing Berlin and Munich and Dresden. War is a terrible thing, and sometimes it's terribly necessary. When you're dealing with evil people who would plunge the world into a nightmare of horror. And that's why the Bible says there was a time for war and a time for peace, but there was a time, sadly, for war. The international community has to declare war on terror. War on terror. A Gaddafi has got to learn that if he will not let others live, he will not live. And if that is not a happy thing, let me tell you, people who live in the Middle West or the Far West don't understand the Middle East. It's a different mentality. It's a different thinking. We're dealing with people who hate America not because of Israel. The tragedy is that in the Middle East, there is a general hatred of America.
No.
I'm deeply impressed by your no. It's a general hatred of Iran doesn't hate America because of Israel only. It hates America because it is Satan itself. And in the Muslim world, if you think that they will live with Jews, look at Lebanon. Who today is killing Muslims in Lebanon, and who is killing Christians in Lebanon? You expect me to believe you and your clients? Arabs not only won't live with Jews, they don't live with themselves.
Mr. McCloskey, 4 minutes to answer.
I think that answer describes the difference between us tonight. I don't believe that you answer hatred with more hatred. I think that if you preach hatred, that Arabs hate Jews and the Jews hate Arabs, you're going to prolong this into eternity. I've been in the Middle East, I think, on 5 occasions, and on each of those occasions, I have found Arabs who want to live in peace with Israel and Israelis who want to live in peace with the Arab world. I think peoples, like individuals, are probably in a constant battle for their good side and their bad side. We're all capable of kindness. We're all capable of cruelty and vengeance. And I think to preach that Arabs as a race hate Jews as a race is dead wrong. They're both Semitic. If there's anybody who ought to understand hatred, it's we Irish. We've been killing each other in Northern Ireland for 300 years because one was Catholic and one was Protestant. It's crazy to go on doing this. Now, there are moderates in both sides of the Irish question. There are moderates on both sides of the Israeli and the Jewish and the Arab question. The moderates that predominate in Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, in my judgment, are far more numerically strong than are those who want to go to war. Now, Rabbi Kahana speaks in measured tones tonight, but in Israel, he has called the Arabs dogs. Now, if you're called a dog, you're going to hate the person that calls you or treats you like a dog, and that is going to exacerbate the situation. In Israel, the moderate Israelis who would trade land for peace view the Kahana philosophy as more dangerous to Israel than to the Arab world, because he is in effect saying the only Israel we can have is an Israel for Jews alone, and no other party, no other non-Jew should marry a Jew, no other non-Jew should live in Jerusalem. Those are the same things that Hitler taught against the Jews. And if we preserve the right of the Jews, as he would argue, to do that which Hitler did to them, we merely prolong and we cause a recurring cycle of violence one against the other. I want to say this. I have criticized Israel on a number of occasions. I believe that Israel should give up the West Bank. I don't think Israel ought to. I think Israel ought to abide by the UN resolutions. It was the UN that brought Israel into existence and occupied territories. It was the UN that said no nation shall ever increase its territory by force. I think Israel ought to abide by that. But those demands of Israel, to criticize, as Meir Kahan has, the trend of Jewish liberalism, his greatest criticism isn't of those who criticize Israel. It's of fellow Jewish leaders who preach liberalism and human rights for the Arabs as well as the Jews in Israel. And it seems to me that is the basic difference between us. He is basically preaching hatred and racism today to continue this cycle of hate when most Arabs and most Jews that I've met want to end it.
Rabbi Kahana, 2 minutes to rebut on how should the world respond to the latest acts of Arab terrorism.
First of all, I'm always impressed by anti-Zionists' praise of Jewish liberalism. With such friends, we really don't need enemies. The fact of the matter is, sir, whatever the Jewish leadership in this city or other cities may think of Meir Kahana, they know that when push comes to shove, they'll stand with Meir Kahana and the Jewish people against their enemies. Can you imagine? The Arabs begin 5 wars with us. They turn down the UN resolution of 1947. They turn it down. We accept it. They go to war and they lose. 5 wars. And now we hear, you know, Israel should accept the resolution. Such people love Jews after every Holocaust. Well, let me tell you something, and learn it now, after 2,000 years of having enjoyed the benefits and amenities of living under you, thanks but no thanks. If you start a war and you lose, you lose. You don't go back to go. You start the war and you kill our soldiers, and now you have the gall to tell us that we have an obligation to accept that which Arabs didn't? No way. You'll have to learn that this is a new Jew, a different Jew.
Since Arabs' claim of Palestinian state existed, which was created and ruled by Arabs, can you give us the time in history it was created, where its borders were, its capital? What did its flag look like?
There never was a Palestine. And there is no Palestine. And I think it's about time that we understood where the name Palestine came from. The name of the country was Judea. The Romans occupied it, exiled the Jews, and the Roman Emperor Hadrian, in an effort to eliminate the very vestige and memory of Judea, changed its name to Palestina, after the Philistines. Now consider carefully, what if he had not done so? What if he had kept the original name, Judea? And throughout the ages, it would be Judea, on every map, Judea, Judea. Would we now be fighting the Judean terrorists? In every normal state, in every normal context, it is a people that exists and that gives its name to the land. The people who live in that land are Arabs. And I recognize them as such, as part of the Arab nation. And I respect it. And long may they live in any one of their 22 countries. God bless each and every one of them. But Palestine, there never was a Palestine. It was in Eretz Israel. Ask any Baptist. Just as it's about time that people knew what other names were. When you go to Samaria, you'll find a town called Nablus. Nablus. There's no name Nablus. The name of the city was Shechem. It's in the Bible. And if you ask people, why is it Nablus? Well, that's the Arab name. What Arab name? The Romans conquered the country. They changed the name from Shechem to Napulus, as in Naples. Arabs have trouble pronouncing a P. Napulus became Nablus. If anything, we should go back to the Italians. In short, there never was a Palestine. And when the British, perfidious Albion, took over the mandate, not only did they not fulfill the mandate which was to create a Jewish state, but they cut off the east part of the mandate, which was to have been part of a Jewish state, and called it Transjordan. You want to talk about states that don't really exist, not only Palestine, but Jordan, nevertheless, I being basically a flexible person. would be willing, reluctantly, but for the sake of peace, to recognize Jordan.
Mr. McCloskey.
How about Syria? Would you recognize Syria? Would you recognize Iraq? They all fall within the area from the Euphrates to the Nile. What about Egypt? Is this just a concession? Is this a concession by this biblical concept of the greater Israel that we'll accept some borders but not others, and that we want the borders that we have achieved by aggression and by force? It seems to me that if you look at the history of the world, what we did at the end of World War II and what the United States led in doing was to end colonialism and to end imperialism. And we stopped the British and the French and the Dutch and the Portuguese from regaining the territory that they had held at the end of World War I. Most of the countries of Africa, India, Saudi Arabia came out of territories that had previously been held by imperial countries, colonial countries like Britain and France. At the end of World War I, the Picot-Sykes Treaty, a secret treaty which probably broke Woodrow Wilson's heart, divided the former Turkish and Byzantine area of the Arabian Peninsula between the French and the British. But that didn't mean that it gave the Jews a right to it or the Arabs a right. The British, in their perfidious way, had said in 1916, they had said to the Arabs, if you'll fight with us against the Turks, we'll give you your independence in this area at the end of World War I. At the same time, in the Balfour Declaration, they said, we will look favorably, if you Jews will help us in the war against Germany, we'll look favorably upon the establishment of a Jewish homeland. But the Balfour Declaration also said that it will not be in any derogation of the rights of the people living there. When the Palestinian Mandate came into existence, there were at least eight times as many Arabs as Jews living in that area. The fact is, there ought to be an Israel, and there ought to be a Jewish homeland, but there ought not to be the derogation of the right of the people living in that area who have lived there for 2,000 years, long since the Jewish nation was overcome by the Romans. Excuse me.
Our claim,
please. Thank you.
It's like being back in the Knesset. Our claim to the land of Israel is not based upon Britain or the League of Nations or Harry Truman or Joseph Stalin. Our claim is based on the fact that the God of Israel gave the Jewish people a homeland, and we live there. We had two empires there. We never stopped thinking about going back to it. You think that if Great Britain had not promised us that they would not be a Jewish state now? There's a Jewish state despite Britain. There's a Jewish state despite the inaction of the UN. The state of Israel came into being because 6,000 Jews died in blood because Arabs attacked and we beat them. I'm happy to see that you say that there ought to be an Israel. Your logic is not good, because when you say you can't turn back the clock, then therefore the Arabs should accept Israel of 1967. But the Arabs are much more logical than you are. They believe that the entire country is theirs. What makes Haifa or Jaffa less to Arabs than Shechem and Hebron? It doesn't. So I appreciate what you say, but you're not relevant to the Arabs, and I have to face the Arabs and not you. The truth of the matter is that of course the Arabs want to coexist in Israel, since they can't beat them in a war. What does coexistence mean? It means that the Arabs look forward to the day when, because of their higher birth rate, and it is much, much higher than that of the Jews, and because Jews are not coming to Israel because the Zionists in San Francisco do their Zionizing out of the Federation or the JCRC, and because Jews are leaving Israel, the problem is not only one of war on the part of Arabs outside of Israel. The problem is a painful one. Do the Arabs have a right to peacefully become the majority inside Israel? Now, obviously, that's a painful question to ask people, because it points up a tremendous problem of Western democracy versus a Jewish state. Now, the Arabs have no such problem, because there are no Arab democracies. So there are no contradictions. There are no Arab democracies. So they don't let anyone even approach this problem. Israel is a democracy, and it faces not only a democratic problem, a demographic problem. So unless we stop calling me names and start instead thinking of the substance of this problem, Israel is going to be a Northern Ireland, which you wouldn't want. One is enough, right? I therefore pose the question, Israel will have to make the painful, painful decision. Will it allow Western democracy to put an end to a Jewish
religion, race, or sex? And that statement in the Israeli Declaration of Independence is what I believe has caused most of us to support Israel since its inception as a democracy and as a country of equal rights for people, regardless of its religion, race, or sex. Now, what he is saying with the title of this book, they must go. If you're not Jewish, you shouldn't have equal rights in our country. He's proposed three laws which are identical to what Hitler proposed in Nazi Germany in the 1930s. In fact, Jabotinsky, his mentor, who he refers to in this book, was called the Jewish Hitler because he felt that no one but Germans and pure Germans should live in Germany itself and that the Jews should be thrown out. It seems to me that the question is answered by this book. They must go. No longer should religious faith be a matter of equality in Israel. But not only that, because Jews are immigrating out of Israel, he wants to make it a crime for a Jew to marry a non-Jew. We had that in California in 1954. We had a law in this state, you couldn't marry a Chinese, you couldn't marry a Japanese, you couldn't marry a mulatto, you couldn't marry a Filipino. Now, the state of Israel, under Kahana, would adopt a rule that you could only marry a fellow Jew, that no longer would you have political or social or human equality. It seems to me that it's essential, if Israel is to retain the support of the United States, that it retain this provision written into its Declaration of Independence, that human rights and political rights will be equal, irrespective of religion, race, or sex. And he has said that now religion is the question that determines whether you'll be a citizen of the State of Israel with equal rights. That's not just throwing out Arabs, that's throwing out Christians, I assume. I'd like to have an answer to that question. Does that mean if a Jew marries a Christian, it's a crime?
Finish, and I'll answer that question in my 2 minutes. All right?
Mr. McCloskey's concluded. Rabbi Kahana, 2 minutes.
So when you quote me properly. I quoted the Declaration of Independence of Israel, and you quoted part of what I quoted. The other part is on the next page, which says, we hereby declare the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel to be known as the State of Israel. That's the problem. That's the contradiction. It's a problem. The declaration, it has a contradiction in it. Because a Jewish state must mean a state with the majority of Jews, because otherwise it won't be a Jewish state. The problem is that I'm prepared to allow people, anybody, Arabs, to live in Israel. But I'm not prepared to let them wipe out the only Jewish state that we have. The only state that will guarantee us a protection from another Auschwitz. So if the Arabs of Israel, if any non-Jew, would be willing to live in Israel with his personal rights, his economic, cultural, religious, and so on, but not have national rights, he is welcome to live in Israel. And I've stated that over and over again, and I've stated that in this book.
Did he marry a Jew?
Why don't we know?
Now I'm coming to your question. If you think that when Meir Kahane states that a Jew is not allowed to marry a non-Jew, that I discovered America, that I'm Columbus, it's in the Bible. Now, I don't know whether you're a good Bible man, but the fact of the matter is, it's in the Old Testament. It's in the Talmud. There isn't a rabbi, even in this city, who is happy about the fact that Jews marry non-Jews. Not for the absurd demagogic reason that you give, a comparison Chinese and Japanese. It's outrageous to bar a marriage of people because of their race. Judaism has black Jews and white Jews and polka dot Jews, and they all can marry. Judaism is opposed to intermarriage, not because of a person's skin or background, but because Judaism is an idea, a belief, which we want to transmit to our children. Meir Kahane invented this? That's Judaism.
I'd like to comment and just ask Mr. Kahane, Rabbi Kahane, if he is quoted accurately here in the Jewish newspaper. Kahane, quote, "If I have the power, I'll take them out physically. Either they'll leave with reparations or they'll have to leave without the money. If that does not happen, we will kill Arabs here every week. Not me, the Israeli Defense Forces. In the meantime, we have to make their life insufferable. First, the Social Security should be transferred to the hands of the Jewish agency and then pay only Jews. Second, every Arab will have to go to a labor camp for 3 years and serve his reserves there every year after that. If I have 4% of the people on my side, I may be obligated to, according to the Halakha, to take over the government by force." You have to think about that in Eretz. Kahane conducted a tour of the Tel Aviv outdoor markets. His men searched for Arab employees. When a young woman refused to accept their pamphlets, they yelled at her, "Whore, stinking Ashkenazi, leftist." The woman, in turn, called them fascists. When the police wanted to know what he was doing at the market, Kahane said he was just there to wish people a Happy New Year. Is that an accurate quote?
No, that's not an accurate quote.
Why don't you tell us what happened?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. Why not tell me where it's from and what the date is?
The Haaretz is October 5th, 1984. The Halam Mazda is September 23rd, 1984.
Again. Which one? Excuse me, again. That's
Haaretz.
Haaretz and the other one?
It's an Israeli newspaper.
Haaretz, October 5th, 1984, was the conducting tour of the Tel Aviv outdoor markets. The Halam Mazda, September 23rd, 84.
Okay.
Are those accurate?
No. Olam Hazeh is published by a man, Uri Avneri. His magazine, which you quoted from, is one of the great rags. It's half porno and half lies. Incredible for someone such as yourself, who is upset at the news media for being biased towards Israel, and therefore not ready to accept it at face value. But when you like what it says, you accept it at face value. But I can tell you that the news, that you are right on one thing. The news media is biased, the news media is slanted, especially those two papers, which are unbelievably biased papers, that they even make the news media in this country look honest.
Well, I think that was an interesting deviation into the world of the media. So let's conclude the questions with this question, Rabbi Kahane first, is whether you have a view on what the duty of American Jews should be with respect to Israel.
Yes. American Jews should go live in Israel. I'm an Orthodox rabbi, and I don't play games with my Judaism. Judaism is a land-centered faith. The Arab
may have an obligation to visit Mecca once in a lifetime, but not to live there. The Roman Catholic is not obliged to live in Rome. But Judaism has a commandment to live in the land of Israel. When God took the Jews out of Egypt, he didn't merely free them and say, now go live in San Francisco. He freed them and said, go home, all of you, to the land of Canaan, Eretz Israel. The obligation to Israel. You think that we need money? We need Jews. We need Jews to come home and work the land again and fill the land up again with the children of those people who once lived there 2,000 years ago. The country doesn't exist because of checks. It exists because of people who live there and have children, especially you young Jews here. What are you doing here? Go to Israel, get married, have a lot of babies. You don't have to have... Not every Jew has to be a doctor or an attorney or a CPA or marry one. You can learn to live and work with your hands. Build a Jewish house. When must Harris put our houses for us? Zionism came into being to make Jews normal again. Go plant a Jewish tree on a Jewish settlement in Judea, in Samaria, where people such as Abraham lived, and Isaac, and David. That's the obligation of the Jew to Israel. And if you won't, let me add one more thing to you. This is a great country. This is a wonderful country. This is the best country that the Jews have ever known in the exile. But that which was and that which is not necessarily that which will be tomorrow. And if you think that that which happened in Germany is an aberration, it's not true. It's not true. When Jewish leaders in this country say, Kahan is crazy when he says it could happen here. This isn't Germany. That's true. This isn't Germany. But Germany once upon also wasn't Germany. And when Hitler spoke about Juden, Jews, the German Jews said, he doesn't mean us. He means the Ostjuden, the East European Jews, the Polish Jews, the embarrassments. He meant all Jews. I want to tell you that if God forbid there should be a serious economic crash in this country, they will blame the Jews. And I commend every Jewish leader, if you want to know what is happening, stop going to dinners and banquets of national conference of Christians and Jews. Go into a bar, not a trendy bar, a working class bar, and listen as the schnapps goes in, what comes out. So what is the obligation of the Jews to Israel? To save themselves and to save Israel. Go home, a Jewish people in a Jewish state.
Mr. McCloskey.
This is a tougher question for a non-Jew to answer. What is the obligation of a Jew to the state of Israel? But I think I know what it is not. It is not what Yitzhak Shamir said the other day about Edgar Bronfman, an American Jewish leader, when he said, you stay out of Israel's policies. Your obligation is to support Israel. We'll make our foreign policy, and you American Jews must support it. It isn't what Ariel Sharon said to Jews when they were invading Lebanon and 1,000 Jewish leaders met with him on the West Bank, and he said, you owe us support of whatever we do, right or wrong. But Rabbi Kahana is saying is that the American Jew should recognize that Israel is a state coupled with a religious power. And I think that the whole history of the world demonstrates that whenever there has been the collection of political power or armed power coupled with a religious viewpoint, that people of other religious viewpoints are going to be persecuted. It's frightening indeed, it seems to me, to say that Israel must be a Jewish religious state, must accept the boundaries of Israel as established in the Old Testament or 2,200 years ago, and to say that anyone who is not a Jew is not entitled to live in Israel. This law that he has proposed in the Knesset says no non-Jew shall live within the area of the jurisdiction of the city of Jerusalem. That's coupling the religious definition of a Jew with where a person can live. And it seems to me that Jerusalem, which is the center of three great religions, not just Judaism, but Christianity, as well as the Islamic faith, that we are far better off if American Jews accept that the history of the United States Constitution separating church and state is what has made America the most receptive country, not just religious minorities like Jews, but every religious minority can come to this country and practice their religion without fear that they'll be discriminated against by a law, as Meir Kahana would have the laws of Israel discriminate against everyone who is not a Jew. The test for the American Jewish community, it seems to me, is to rise up and speak out against what Rabbi Kahana is suggesting, that the safety and the future of the Jew in America and around the world depends in not going back to Israel and forming a closed state and barring by religious discrimination against everyone else in that state. I would think that the American Jew, above all else, would recognize that the separation of church and state is what gives the Jew some safety and some hope that that discrimination will not be reversed in the future. I don't buy, and I've heard some of my best Jewish friends, people I respect highly, say, someday. Yeah, I guess I'd like to say that also, that it's dead wrong to say people can't have Jewish friends or can't have Arab friends. We fought a lot of wars to create a constitution that said you could have friends of any race and no discrimination based on any race or any religion. And that is a praiseworthy thing. And it doesn't seem to me it is helpful to the Jewish community to urge that a Jew's duty is to Israel first and to reinstate this connection between church and state, which he has argued here tonight.
Summing up for 5 minutes, Rabbi Kahana first, and then Mr. McCloskey, and then we will adjourn. Rabbi?
The state of Israel came into being under a trauma of 2,000 years. The 2,000 years we suffered as a people that had no state. And when we came back, the Arabs in the country did not want to give us that country because they said it was theirs. And I understand them. I understand it. I understand that no Arab in Israel, not one, wants to live in a country which is called the Jewish state, which has a law of return that applies to Jews only, and that law was not passed by Mayor Kahana. I know that there is not one Arab in Israel who enjoys singing his national anthem, Hatikva, with the words, Nefesh Yehudi Homiya, the soul of a Jew yearning. Not one Arab sings that song at the end with the crescendo, Hatikva Bachnot Alpayim, the hope of 2,000 years. He does not break down in tears and say, ah, how my grandparents waited for the Jews to come home. I know that not one Arab in Israel on Independence Day rushes out to celebrate his defeat. I know that the Arabs who live inside Israel hate Israel. I understand that. Because I have national pride, I can understand others who have national pride. And I know that you can't buy an Arab's pride by raising his living standards. Not by an indoor toilet does an Arab live. And when Jews say, when unfortunate Jewish leaders who are tiny and myopic dwarfs say, we came to Israel, found the desert, turned into a garden. The Arab says, you're right, but it was my desert. But it's your garden. Every Arab in this room is saying to himself, he's right. So I know what they think, and I understand them. They're wrong, of course. It was both my desert and my garden, but I certainly won't change their minds. And therefore, I know that we are in a desperate struggle to survive. I have no peace plan, because I'm not a demagogue. Anyone who tells you that he has a peace plan is a demagogue. Of course I want peace. I want peace more than anyone sitting in this room, because I don't live in this room or in this city. I'm not a fool. We may have to be a garrison state for another 50 years or 100 years. I don't want love. I'm sick and tired of wanting the world's love. They love us after every Holocaust. They give us plaques and monuments after Auschwitz. Jimmy Carter gives us a Holocaust commission for Elie Wiesel to play with. I'm tired of Kaddish, tired of Yahrzeit. I don't want love, I want respect. And I want to say quite clearly to my adversary and to all the adversaries there, most Jews have a problem. Being the product of 2,000 years as a minority, it's hard to be normal. They're riddled with guilt. I have no guilt feelings. It is better to be a winner than to be a loser. And it is better to live than to die. And it's better to have a state of Israel that is hated by the whole world than an Auschwitz that's loved by it.
Mr. McCloskey.
That's a moving appeal, but it's founded essentially on a racist argument that Arabs somehow should not be allowed to live in a particular country. And the whole legal foundation that set up the State of Israel was based, as the Jews themselves recognized, that people other than Arabs or other than Jews could live in that country. To suggest that no Christian should live within the city of Jerusalem is tantamount to starting the Crusades all over again. It seems to me that to take the desire of an Israel to live in peace and to say that peace must be founded on the expulsion of Arabs and the expulsion of Christians from the city of Jerusalem is to guarantee, he said it here in a law that he has introduced in the Knesset, that no Christian shall live in the city of Jerusalem. He applies the same test that the Jew, the religious Jew, ought to be essentially the sole governor of this nation of Israel. If that is the position that Rabbi Kahana takes, I suspect that Israel will within a decade have lost the support of the United States people. And this kind of concept that Arabs, and then never a definition, never a speaking of one Arab as a good Arab. What about Issam Sartoui or Fuad Kouazmi, who called for the recognition of Israel? He would have Israel exist by being a garrison state. And if that exists for another 10 years, I fear that Arab leaders will obtain the atomic capacity just as Israel, in its concern, has obtained an atomic capacity. And the concern that that leads to is that even though it is a war between Israeli and what he characterizes the Arab world, with no recognition that there are Arab moderates and there's no such thing as an Arab friend, and if I were an Israeli or an American Jew that wanted to see Israel survive and prosper, I would try to preach an end to this hatred before the Israeli or the Arab world comes into the possession of some kind of nuclear weapon. That's the danger to this country, and it's a danger to Israel. It is a complete antithesis to the American concept of a separation of church and state. It guarantees a continuation of hatreds, and that hatred is ultimately going to lead, in my judgment, to a bloodier war than we have ever seen. I don't know that there can be a nuclear explosion in that part of the world without we and the Soviets going on the kind of alert that could lead to the kind of a mistake that could lead to an overall nuclear war. I respected a man who believes what he says. It's based on the Bible and the Old Testament and this historic right of 2,000 years to the State of Israel, but I just think he's dead wrong in urging a combination of state power coupled with religious conviction.
Ladies and gentlemen, will you, by your applause, please thank Mr. McCloskey, Rabbi Kahana, for spending the time with us. Thank you.